Okay, we have a lot to cover this evening. Genesis 24 to 26 is the span of chapters that we have. It's 136 verses, by the way. The first section, if you want to open to Genesis 24, the first section is more narrative. So what I'm going to do is have spontaneous readers just to read short passages, not really long ones, so that we can go through that one. And we'll have a few questions interspersed in the first section. And then in the second section, chapter 25, I'll summarize. And chapter 26 will be a summary, too. What I'm likening it to is almost a series of tableaux, as if you were in a play. So we have Isaac marries Rebecca, Abraham's marriage, death and descendants, his second marriage, birth of Esau and Jacob, Jacob steals the birthright, God's promise to Isaac and Abimelech. So scene one, we start out in the beginning, chapter 24, Isaac marries Rebecca. Up to this point, we've all gotten a great introduction about how Abraham had been abundantly blessed, and now he's looking towards the future. So he's looking towards his descendants, and specifically in this part, Isaac. So we'll go through and we'll read, in this chapter, we'll read the short sections of verses, and then I'll make a few comments and maybe throw out a question or two for each section, just to keep you all awake. So we have verses 1 to 8. If someone would be so kind as to read that section, please.
Now Abraham was old and well advanced in years, and the Lord had blessed Abraham in all things. And Abraham said to his servant, the oldest of his household, who had charge of all that he had, put your hand under my thigh, that I may make you swear by the Lord, the God of heaven and the God of earth, that you will not take a wife for my son from the daughters of the Canaanites, among whom I dwell, but will go away to my country and to my kindred, and take a wife for my son Isaac. The servant said to him, perhaps the woman may not be willing to follow me to this land. Must I then take your son back to the land from which you came? Abraham said to him, see to it that you do not take my son back there. The Lord, the God of heaven, who took me from my father's house and from the land of my kindred, and who spoke to me and swore to me, to your offspring, I will give this land. He will send his angel before you, and you shall take a wife for my son from there. But if the woman is not willing to follow you, then you will be free from this oath of mine. Only you must not take my son back there.
Thank you. So this I call it, I give a heading, the servant's oath. And at this point, from what I understand, Isaac's age is approximately 40. And the oath also mentions there are specific lines that can be in an oath in the ancient world, and one of them is the God of heaven and the earth. So what strikes you as unusual, here's the question for this section, about Abraham's address to his servant. That would be verses 2 to 4. Anyone?
What's unusual about the oath?
About the Abraham, the way he addresses it to his servant. It's a senior servant.
So do you think this is Eliezer, who would have inherited everything if he hadn't have had Isaac? I think that's the first thing that comes to my mind.
I didn't do any research on that.
Uh-huh.
So I don't have any research on that. What I'm looking for was about the specific address, that it was a negative command, wasn't it? It wasn't something positive. So that's what I was looking for. So in a sense, it's almost like a mission impossible. He You know, this is his mission impossible. His mission is to go out and look for this woman from their own family clan, right? Mm-hmm. Not the Canaanite. So as for the servant himself, the only information that I have so far is that he would have been a trusted servant, of course, and a senior level servant. And there's relationship in there between Abraham's, even his will and last testament. So it had to be someone very trusted. So that's all I have about the servant for this passage. So the servant turned it around, didn't he? The servant turned around and said, but what if? What if this? There's no guarantee that the chosen woman, the chosen one, would follow. So this was interesting. They had such a relationship that he wanted to turn around and ask him, what do I do if this particular situation? And then he also mentions about the angel. Let's see which verse it is. The Lord God of heaven, verse 7, here it is. The Lord God of heaven will send an angel before you. So even though it was a negative command, you know, the servant had a trusted relationship, so they were able to establish what this mission impossible was. The verse 7 also extended to the extended family, multiple generations was the basic stable social grouping. For the phrase, my father's house, is what that really means.
Okay, you repeat that? What is, what else
is that? My father's house, uh-huh, in number 7, verse 7.
Relates
to extended family and the multiple generation,
multiple
because that was the, in that part of the world, it was the basic stable social grouping. Okay, so let's read on. So it starts out quite interestingly with this mission impossible. And in French, it could be even chercher la femme, look for the woman. Okay, so we'll go now to verses 9 to 14. Someone could read that passage.
And the servant put his hand under the thigh of Abraham, his master, and swore to him concerning that matter. And the servant took 10 camels of the camels of his master and departed, for all the goods of his master were in his hand. And he arose and went to Mesopotamia unto the city of Nahor. And he made his camels to kneel down without the city by a well of water at the time of evening, even the time that women go out to draw water. And he said, O Lord God of my master Abraham, I pray thee, send me good speed this day, and show kindness unto my master Abraham. Behold, I stand here by the well of water, and the daughters of the men of the city come out to draw water. And let it come to pass that the man said to whom I shall say, let down thy pitcher, I pray thee, that I may drink. And she shall say, drink, and I will give thy camels drink also. Let that be the same thing that thou hast appointed for thy servant Isaac, and thereby shall I know that thou hast shown kindness unto my master.
Okay, thank you. So again, what do you find intriguing about the servant's preparation to swear the oath? Once again, it's somewhat repetitive of what we said before.
Put your hand under my thigh, that part?
Well, just as preparation. Once again, he needs his actions clarified before he begins, just in full reassurance. So he's sort of hedging his bets about what to do. And he was sent to Padam Aram. And the literal Hebrew is Aram Naharim, Aram of the two rivers. So you have the Tigris and the Euphrates, just like someone had a map, I think it was Becky, the Tigris and the Euphrates. And that whole region is basically what is later called Mesopotamia by the Greeks, okay? And Mesopotamia between the rivers. Again, the same meaning, with just one is Hebrew, one is Greek. And so this would be about a month's journey, apparently. that he would take. So we still have this, the servant is still the prime character here in a sense, and Abraham, of course, but notice the detail that the scripture puts in. If you look at it in a literary way, notice the detail that the camels themselves kneeled by the well. It's almost as though the servant parked the car, right? Hold on, sit the camels down there, the patients. I found it very, very interesting. And also it's a propitious time of the day when the daughters of the men of the city are coming out to draw the water. So it would have been probably the evening from what I was reading in an NIV commentary today, because the cool would probably have cooled down a bit, and that's usually when people, they wouldn't come out in the middle of the day in the Middle East, so they would come out towards the cooler part of the day. And also it was a tradition, of course, to get the water at a certain time. And then, as you know, in the Middle East today, there's communal wells, and that's often where a lot of shops are around the same area, if you've ever traveled to the Middle East. It hasn't changed a lot, really. And then the notice in verse 14, the verse that Mariella read, the very last verse, notice how he continually is trusting in his master small m and his master capital M. So the servant is really echoing a lot of Abraham's relationship with his Lord. And I found that rather interesting. Next section, 15 to 21. I have to move along because there's a lot of verses.
But, you know, Jeannie, I do think it's interesting in verse 12.
Yes.
That he prayed. He asked specifically.
Yeah. Exactly. Exactly.
And it happened before he had finished speaking that, behold, Rebekah, who was born to Bethuel, son of Milcah, the wife of Nahor, Abraham's brother, came out with her pitcher on her shoulder. Now the young woman was very beautiful to behold, a virgin. No man had known her. And she went down to the well, filled her pitcher, and came up. And the servant ran to meet her and said, please let me drink a little water from your pitcher. So she said, drink, my lord. Then she quickly let her pitcher down to her hand and gave him a drink. And when she had finished giving him a drink, she said, I will draw water for your camels also until they have finished drinking. Then she quickly emptied her pitcher into the trough, ran back to the well to draw water, and drew for all his camels. And the man, wondering at her, remained silent so as to know whether the Lord had made his journey prosperous or not.
Okay, thank you, Millie. All right, so this one I titled Opportunity Knocks, if we're in our play, okay? You have an attractive woman who's young, a virtuous woman, marriageable age, and even before he finished speaking, Rebecca appears, and it says the servant ran to speak with her, and it seems like such a simple verb, but it appears again later on, the servant ran to speak with her. His prayer vision appeared to be coming true before his very eyes. So my question here is, what was Rebecca's attitude? We look at it from the female viewpoint. That would be, I think I had verse 20 written down.
She had a very willing spirit. I mean, she had to go down into the well to get water for all those kids.
Exactly, and pour it into the trough. So her attitude was hospitable because she not only gave water to him, but also to his camels. And also, what else was it? What else did you notice about what she said? Verse 19, it would be.
Well, until they had finished drinking. I mean, camels can hold a lot of water.
That's right. But verse 19, she also says what? She says, my lord. So she's being respectful, right? So it's hospitality and respect. That's what I was looking for there. Right, exactly. And the time period for the camels to receive the water. So she had the patience and the hospitable character to fill up the camels, as it were. Okay, so we'll move on to 22 to 28. The story continues.
When the camels had finished drinking, the man took a gold ring weighing half a shekel and two bracelets for her arms weighing 10 gold shekels and said, "Please tell me whose daughter you are. Is there room in your father's house for us to spend the night?" She said to him, "I am the daughter of Bethuel, the son of Milcah, whom she bore to Nahor." She added, "We have plenty of both straw and fodder and room to spend the night." The man bowed his head and worshipped the Lord and said, "Blessed be the Lord, the God of my master Abraham, who has not forsaken his steadfast love and his faithfulness toward my master. As for me, the Lord has led me in the way to the house of my master's kinsman." How far did you want me to read? Sorry.
28.
Okay. Then the young woman ran and told her mother's household about these things.
Thank you. Okay, so in this section, I called it a captivating conversation. So here we see a gesture of the gift of the gold ring. I'm sorry, a nose ring and two gold bracelets. And apparently a shekel is about 11 grams and a bakah, the gold nose ring, is about a half a shekel, and then the bracelets to two gold bracelets. So it could be perhaps a symbol that to show that his word was trustworthy. Then we get into the family relationships. And as it turns out, if you analyze all the family relationships, this was the house of the master's kinsman. And it turns out that it would have been, if you compare her to Isaac, she would be his father's great niece. Okay, so just if you can imagine that in your family relationships. Isaac's father's great niece.
So
Abraham's great niece. Yeah, Abraham's great niece. Okay. So she's identifying herself first by her father Bethuel, and then by her grandmother Milcah. And then Abraham's brother is Nahor, who married Milcah and had Bethuel. Therefore, Rebekah is Milcah and Nahor's granddaughter. So the house was the house of the kinsmen. And notice, one thing I noticed was that Rebekah does not reveal her own name. She just identifies herself by her kinsmen, her family relationships, which could have been a cautious move. We don't know. In the context of the day, she's kind but cautious of the stranger, is how I saw it. I mean, that's basically, I'm inferring that, you know, from the reading. There might have been another reason. I don't know. So then we look at, I thought what was interesting was just what the response, again, we're seeing a repetition of the servant and Rebekah. What responses did we see to all this that was happening so quickly, so fast? I mean, all this is happening rather quickly. How did they respond as far as spiritually?
How did Rebecca's household respond spiritually?
How did Rebecca and the servant both respond spiritually? Say verses 26 to 27 ahead.
The servant worshipped.
Exactly.
Praise to God.
Right, just as we did tonight, the servant's prayer of praise and gratitude to the Lord for his faithfulness and steadfast love. And then we see a physical response by Rebecca in that, again, the verb to run. She ran to her mother's household. So perhaps we could construe it would be an air of excitement, perhaps. And it's hard to say what the context would be in that time period. But okay, so we'll go on and we'll go to 29 to 35 would be the next section. Anybody?
Now, Rebekah had a brother named Laban. As soon as he saw the ring and the bracelets on his sister Rebekah and heard her words about what the man had said to her, Laban rushed outside to the man at the spring. When he reached him, he was still standing by the camels at the spring. So he said to him, "Come, blessed of the Lord, why are you staying outside when I have made the house ready for you, as well as a place for the camels?"
The man went inside, and while the camels were being unloaded and provided straw with straw and fodder, water was brought to bathe his feet and the feet of the men who were with him. But when the table was set for him, he said, "I will not eat until I have told my tale." "Do so," they replied. "I am Abraham's servant," he began.
That's right, 35. Mm-hmm.
"The Lord has blessed my master so abundantly that he has become a wealthy man. He has given him flocks and herds, silver and gold, male and female slaves, and camels and asses."
Okay, thank you. So in this section, on verse 29, I call it Meet the Relatives. Okay, it's not just Mary, Rebecca, but you've got Laban in there, who is a bit of a controversial figure later on. So we have the introduction of Laban in this section. And then after this section, we have basically the whole story as the servant story is revisited. So the whole story is repeated again by the servant, but with enhanced details. So if you can remember Lawrence of Arabia, when, you know, he comes in the tent and tells all the details, it's the Middle East hasn't changed in that regard. The oral history of the ancient world is very strong, so storytelling is in their tradition. And so Abraham's possessions and riches, and as well as our miraculous birth of his son Isaac, was very emphasized. So it's not as though he's adding details, he's more or less enhancing the story a bit when he retells it. So we're not going to read through the whole retelling then. So what I will say is that since there was no eHarmony Christian computer dating in the ancient world, this was it. This was how it was working in this case. The bracelets and the arm on the ring on the nose were significant as part of a bride price, is what it's called. The meeting was a divine appointment, and the pressure was put on Laban in this case to honor the master. So in verse 50 following, it's Laban and Bethuel who negotiate for the bride. And often, apparently, I didn't know this, the brother often played a dominant role in the bridal negotiations for a sister. And also there were additional lavish gifts mentioned here of silver, gold, and garments. And also some of the gifts according to verse 53, some of the gifts were to the brother and the mother as well. And then she had basically one night to sleep on the whole decision, along with the whole family. A bit of a major decision. So, and then in verse 59, we have the departure of Rebecca, includes servants, a nurse, and then the young men and Abraham's men as well. So the customs of the ancient Near East, when she comes back towards to meet Isaac, she's veiled. So apparently, I just wanted to add that the veil for the unmarried women, was in the presence of men at that time, also special occasions such as a wedding or a funeral. And notice that there was a blessing given on Rebecca, verse 61 as well. Okay, so the final part we'll go to here in this little tableau is 62 to 67. If anyone could read that part.
"Now Isaac had come from going to Beer Lahai-Roi, where he was living in the Negev. Isaac went out to meditate in the field toward evening, and he lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, camels were coming. Rebekah lifted up her eyes, and when she saw Isaac, she dismounted from the camel. She said to the servant, 'Who is that man walking in the field to meet us?' And the servant said, 'He is my master.' Then she took her veil and covered herself. The servant told Isaac all the things that he had done." So 67?
Yes.
"Then Isaac brought her into his mother Sarah's tent, and he took Rebekah, and she became his wife, and he loved her. Thus Isaac was comforted after his mother's death."
Thank you. So this part I call matchmaker, matchmaker, fiddler on the roof. The meeting of Isaac and Rebekah for the first time. They both noticed that they both lifted up their eyes. It's very interesting. And the servant, again, relays the entire story. And so I'm assuming that when someone goes into the tent, or it's sort of almost like a pre-engagement type idea. But I didn't research that, so I don't have anything to tell you about that particular item. So anyway, that was the matchmaker. So now I'll zoom into chapter 25. Verses, we're not going to read through all this because it's just too many verses. So I'll summarize. Verses 1 to 18, we've got Abraham's marriage to Keturah, his death, and his descendants. So Keturah, apparently her name means spices or incense. I didn't get to look this up today. I ran out of time, but apparently there's another reference in First Chronicles, but I didn't get a chance to look it up, sorry, 132, that's supposedly there's a possibility that she could have been a concubine and not a wife. So there's some kind of controversy with that, but I don't really have the details to really say which one I think it is. So, but apparently there's some question about that. But anyway, it doesn't really matter. He had a lot of children with her. But in the end, Abraham gave all he had to Isaac, which is interesting because he was in line with God's plan. According to the ancient Near Eastern law, a father could designate his heir, and that goes back to this Code of Hammurabi. So there were these specific gifts to the sons of concubines, but they were, in a sense, sent away to a different location. So there's all this different traditions. And then Abraham's death was 175, but apparently 100 years of those, I just read today, he was in the Promised Land. So then his bones were gathered to his people, like almost like a family vault or tomb. And then Isaac and Ishmael buried him along with Sarah. And then we're in chapter 25 now. So verse 11, you see, after the death of Abraham, God blessed Isaac, his son. So that was a very simple verse, in a sense, just like the ones where they were running. It seems like such a simple activity, but it is important in a sense because you see the blessing continuing there in the descendants. So I thought that was a simple but important verse. And then in 12 to 18, can't really go into all this tonight, but Ishmael's descendants are not overlooked. But there's also mention of some negativity because they settled, I read today in the NIV that it was almost an alienation, that you see where they were settled opposite Egypt in the direction of Assyria. So even though they were all mentioned, there's still a little bit of alienation compared to the others. Then we get into the birth of Esau and Jacob, verses 19 to 28. And I know you're probably all very biblically literate, so you, assuming you know a lot about this story, birth of Esau and Jacob. Isaac is now about 60 years old and has been childless for about 20 years. This is Isaac now. So despite the covenant promise, and he prays to the Lord on behalf of his wife, Rebecca, for fertility, whereas Rebecca prays to the Lord to ask about the twins struggling in the womb. So two separate prayers, it would appear, we don't really know. They weren't necessarily praying together. They're praying separate prayers. Key verse 23, and the Lord said to her, two nations are in your womb and two peoples from within you shall be divided. The one shall be stronger than the other, the older shall serve the younger. So that's your key verse in that chapter. Lost my place here. Right, so there's an ancient law called a primogenitor law where the younger is usually subservient to the elder child. But there's a lot of cases in the Old Testament where it's the opposite way. So, you know, there's no set pattern. And that just shows that God doesn't necessarily favor one or the other. It's just whoever is doing the Lord's will. I thought that was pretty interesting. Of course, in Esau, similar to the Hebrew word for red, and Jacob, there's this significance of the names. You know, he takes the heel, as he grabbed the heel in the womb, or he cheats. In the Old Testament survey, this is a book I used, Old Testament survey, Lasor, Hubbard, and Bush. They depict Jacob as crafty and scheming individual, and his 20-year service with Uncle Laban is marked by a continual struggle and scheming between them. Of course, there's an issue in verse 28 of the favoritism. You know, Isaac loved Esau, Rebekah loved Jacob. And then verses 29 to 34 would be the next little scene in the play. Esau sells his birthright. Apparently, the birthright was an important family custom, gave the firstborn rights and preferential status and a double portion of inheritance, also involved family leadership. Birthrights were exchangeable according to the Nuzi laws from Mesopotamia, which this Archaeology Bible had a bit about the Nuzi texts, where there sometimes was an exchange of birthrights for something like, you know, three sheep or something like that. It was another reference to someone else, not necessarily a biblical reference, but, you know, it was something that happened once in a while that someone would trade their birthright. Because the other book I read, which was Archaeology of the Old Testament by Al Hirt, who was one of my husband's professors in college in archaeology at Wheaton, he seemed to think in his book that, you know, it was really pretty ridiculous that Esau would go ahead and sell his birthright. And it seems sort of such a trivial thing to do at such a weakened moment. But apparently he regretted it greatly later. We see that. So he realized then that it was the wrong thing to do. But it would have been a legal exchange, even if it was an oral agreement. And then there's all the thing about, apparently in Obadiah, which I didn't research, there's a lot of information about Israel and Edom and how this all played out later on about the nations of being, you know, the younger and the elder and the younger. And apparently the two nations are inextricably bound together from their birth in the tents of Isaac and Rebekah. Obadiah, this isn't me saying this is from the author of the Old Testament, pronounces that Edom will be despised among the nations, the same word used to describe how Esau despised his birthright. Edom's attack on Israel was more than simply a matter of international politics and opportunism. It was the betrayal of a brother and a strike against God's plan. So it's just the whole idea that they started out as brothers, but then they ended up, as it can end up, all that hatred can, you know, end up being the division of the nations, or whatever, that enmity, or whatever, and how that can go on to a grand scale. And apparently a blessing also is a binding and irrevocable will. So the blessing, it wasn't just somebody just patting someone on the head. It was just as binding as a legal. So now we go to chapter 26, the last chapter, and this is verses, has 35 verses. This is God's promise to Isaac and Abimelech. Okay, so if we turn to that chapter, you'll see in verses 1 to 5, we have a famine that caused Isaac to go to Abimelech, who was the king of a city-state of the Philistines, but they're not sure. It's not clear whether it's the same Abimelech that Abraham dealt with, the same monarch that he dealt with in 2021. Because there's a lot of apparently multiple names in the royalty in Egypt. For example, the name Ramses. There's over 11 kings named Ramses. It's not just one Ramses. So they don't really know whether this was the same Abimelech. I mean, so This was apparently a theophany. You know, the Lord appeared to him and said, don't go to Egypt. Reminds me a bit of a Christmas story in some ways about, you know, the baby in Egypt. Evidently, God wanted him to stay in the promised land. So then in verses 6 to 11, I'm just going to summarize. So Isaac and Rebekah settled in, don't know how to say it, Gerar, I think, the same city that Abraham visited years ago. Almost identical scenario to Abram and Sarah about the sister, you know, passing off as their sister. So Abimelech was angry when he discovered they were man and wife. He sent out a warning to his people so that no one could touch either Isaac or Rebekah. So verses 12 to 16, like his father, Isaac was blessed by God and became wealthy. But notice that it said it doesn't just say that God gave him wealth. It said that he also sowed and reaped. In other words, he worked for his wealth. So there was some question about whether this was envy or enmity or contention. All of a sudden, I was still looking for the answer to this question this morning, and I looked up in the NIV, and it just said, you know, it just could have been that there was just they saw God's people as a threat, that Abimelech saw them as a threat, that this was pretty common, that it wasn't just this situation, that it could have been any situation like this where they saw them as a threat. So Abimelech sends him away and they go out. And then there's this whole thing about the wells. I don't know if you all had a chance to read this chapter before you came. But there's the names of the three wells. So it's very sort of Lawrence of Arabia here, you know. Contention, enmity, and broad place or room. So we're just waiting, you know, for Omar Sharif to enter the room and talk about the well. You know, it's just that whole thing of how they're disputing over the wells. So apparently the disputes over the water rights, I just read this morning in the NIV, were very common to dispute over the water rights. So I think the wells were just used in a sense as a point of contention by Abimelech. That's just my own feeling that, you know, he somehow just wanted to use it to just stir up something against him, perhaps, I don't know. And then verses 23 to 25, there was one in Beersheba called the Well of the Oath. And this is the one where he worshiped the Lord at an altar, pitched a tent, dug a well. Then Abimelech shows up, 26 to 31, with his advisor, and they have a confrontation, or at least at the very least, it could be an assumption of actual enmity or hatred. I guess enmity and hatred are the same thing, or at the very least, a falling out. Then Abraham proposes a covenant between Isaac and himself. So this whole covenant thing, they have a feast, and their oaths were exchanged the next morning. And then the next day, it says, the Bible gives the detail that the water wells up in this. And to this day, Beersheba is still a known place. So the name stuck with the Beersheba and the seven new wells. So the wells came up. And then the last little bit of this is that Esau has taken two Hittite wives, a detail that they made life bitter for Isaac and Rebekah. And so I sort of laughed when I saw the last verse because it seemed like such a silly thing to put there. But of course, we make the divisions of the verses, you know, they didn't. But the point is that God cares about the mundane, you know. These two wives are making life bitter for him. So that's God cares about these mundane problems that we all have. So the meditation points that I had on the end were, and I think I'm finishing up now, the meditation points would be, do we include God when we're making our plans for the future? So that would be from the first section about the servant and looking for the wife for Isaac. Do we listen to God's directives through the proper sources to make wise decisions? And just look at that whole major decision that was made, you know, and how all the permutations that went through to have the right decision made and the wise decision made. Abraham looking out for his family, Isaac looking for wife, Rebecca's family and all that. And then do we truly believe God's promises? Just, you know, thoughts to think about through the week. Do we truly believe God's promises, his providence and his provision in every aspect of our lives? So I thought that this particular aspect, you know, was good to meditate on, just to show that, you know, God's providence through the whole thing, despite all of the Middle Eastern customs of the arranged marriages and all this, you know, how God worked through all those custom and culture of the time. And so that is all I have. Sufi Nation's finished.
Great. You know, I thought it was interesting in the beginning of 24, Abraham is adamant that Isaac is not supposed to go back to his homeland because God sent Abram out of Ur. And so Abram is honoring, you know, what God told him to do by making sure his son doesn't go back to a comfort zone or whatever. And I thought that was neat that Abraham was very adamant about
it. Right, exactly. And it was almost like a command. And that's what I started off by saying. It almost was like a command in the negative. But it was clear that he didn't want, and he gave the what if as well. If this doesn't happen, you know, he made sure he didn't want Isaac to go and have a wife from the Canaanites.
Well, it's funny how this passage that you taught is bookended by Abraham starting off saying, go find a wife from our own people. And then the very last verse is Esau marrying the Hittite. And so it's just, I think that really highlights the fact that, you know, that the line of the blessing, you know, that Abraham is following the command and the people who the blessing is passed on to are following that command, whereas Esau does the very opposite thing that Abraham is, you know, is commanded to
do.
That's right. His son.
That's true. That's a good bookending notice that.
Another kind of interesting thing, because in my memory, the way Abraham was caught lying to this to these kings was by he was seen caressing his wife. Is that true? Well, it says for Isaac, my Bible says that he saw them laughing. He saw him laughing. Now, the note says that could mean intimacy, right? Mm-hmm. But it's interesting that they would use that verb, which of course goes along with his name, versus like caressing or, because I want to say when Abraham was found out, I mean, I'd have to go back and look, but I want to say that he was seen caressing his wife, and that's, they used something more along those lines rather than laughing.
Oh, okay. Right, I think I read something, I don't know which book it was in, something about a word, it could have been a word exchange, like some kind of term of endearment, but I don't know where I read it, but it was a speculation, but there's some kind of, perhaps something they may have exchanged, that obviously there was something there that they exchanged, whether a term of endearment that made him immediately know that it was they were not a brother and sister. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Be sure your sin will find you out.
The ESV that says laughing at the provision.
What does yours say,
Esther? Yeah, that's what mine says.
Oh, does it? Okay. Oh, okay. Well, there's some things we didn't know. Maybe.
Turn it up a little bit.
Maybe they have to read between the lines.
Yeah.
That I don't know.
I thought it was interesting in chapter 25, it says that Ishmael and Isaac buried Abraham
together.
Yeah. Because the last time we heard, you know, Ishmael was sent away, right? Mm-hmm. So there evidently was some kind of restoration.
Mm-hmm. At least in the short term.
Yeah. That Isaac would allow that. I mean, as his sole heir, he would have probably, I would think, have had some kind of ability to make sure that Ishmael was not involved with that.
Right. Mm-hmm. Seems like in a lot of ways he was a peacemaker. Mm-hmm. He meant well.
Yeah. And things change so rapidly because if we study another chapter, other things will come out about the same characters. So it's hard to stick to the same chapter. Like, well, you know how Laban would happen.
Yeah, yeah.
He got the reputation. And you know there's more to the story. That's why I sort of made it a play, because I'm thinking that could bring it into the reality of the situation at the moment, you know. Because, yeah, things change with all the characters.
Of course, the water rights issues don't change. They haven't changed. Still a huge issue in Israel and with their neighbors, you know. Mm-hmm. Huge issue.
Yes.
And I would love to know how much at the end of chapter 24 is custom, and because like you read it and you say, it says Rebecca sees this person and goes, who is that? And oh, that's the master. And then she puts her veil on, though, and you can totally make a romance movie out of that, you know, like all the stuff.
Does it remind you like the end of Pride and Prejudice? Yeah. You know, walking through the fields and he loves and she loves, I know.
That's right. So I called it matchmaker, yeah. Like Fiddler on the Roof.
Jenny, thank you very much. It was wonderful.
Oh,
I scribbled on my sheet. Let me turn this off real quick.